Hello, and welcome to Sherlock, from Adler to Amberley. An attempt to analyse all 56 of the Sherlock Holmes short stories by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, in order. Starting with the first story, A Scandal in Bohemia, featuring the celebrated adventuress Irene Adler, and finishing with the final story of the casebook of Sherlock Holmes, The Retired Colourman, where Holmes and Watson accept the case from Mr. Josiah Amberley. Hence, from Adler to Amberley. My name is Carl Kopak, and I'll be presenting this irregular series along with a special guest as we attempt to assess the value of each tale of the canon. A recap of The Adventure of the Missing Three-Quarter by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. We're in Baker Street again, in the usual room. Watson's not doing much, but Holmes is reading a telegram which has absolutely stymied him. He hasn't got a clue what's going on. It's from a man called Cyril Overton from Cambridge, and he's basically saying that without Godfrey Staunton, he's done. And then he leaves a huge amount of sort of rugby union terms, which I must admit I can't begin to understand. Holmes has no idea what it is, but the man himself turns up says, yep, that's the case. Godfrey Staunton, who is a missing three-quarter, apparently that is a rugby thing, I'm not sure, has disappeared. They were staying just off the Strand. They've got a big match tomorrow, the varsity game against Oxford. So once again, it's Cambridge against Oxford again. They're staying on the Strand. They're going to have this big, important match tomorrow. But without Godfrey, they will be undone. That's not good. Holmes is baffled. Holmes, despite apparently having gone to university, has no knowledge of amateur sport whatsoever. But he says, well, you know, there's clearly work for me here, so I'll get involved, which he duly does. Overton says that Staunton was a bit distracted, not quite on it, and but you know, he said he was okay and he was going to play and he was going to be okay, but they couldn't really get down to why he was looking a bit sort of drawn. And he said later on in the night, Overton went round to see him to make sure he was okay, he said, yeah, he's going to be fine. We found out that before Staunton went to bed, the porter brought up a note from him from a bearded man. Not a gentleman, but not as, you know, not a scallywag or anything. It didn't look particularly evil, but, you know, with a note for Staunton. And Staunton's reaction was very, very profound. He, you know, it had incredibly bad news on it. He was distraught. And then he left the hotel with the bearded man. And they were seen running towards the Strand about 10:30, and no one had seen them since. Overton had got in contact with Cambridge to see if he was there, and no. And then he got in touch with a man called Lord Mount James, who is his uncle, an absolute miser. And I love the description of so riddled with gout that you could chalk a billiard cue with his knuckles, which I thought was very nice. It's one of my favourite lines in the entire canon, that. Lord Mount St. James is Godfrey's heir, and you know, he's a very old man, not a very nice one. Holmes is, you know, tries to work out what's going on. He's talking to the porter, they said, he didn't leave a note. He didn't take a notebook anywhere else, so, you know, he didn't really, the porter didn't really do much. But Mount James, but they go to the blotter to see what his reply was. So he did write a reply, but he took it with him. And the only last thing they could remit are the words, stand by us for God's sake. Stand by us, which is, of course, means that there's other people involved. Mount James turns up and is tremendous, I've got to say. And he's saying, like, you know, don't look for a penny for me, Mr. Detective. I'm not doing any, you know, don't expect me to pay for any of this. And Holmes basically, Watson's fooled by this. I have no idea how. Holmes basically, if you'll excuse my language, he takes the piss out of him and just says, I'll tell you what that'll be a kidnapping note. And he's heard about your wealth. And Mount James says, hang on, maybe you can have a few quid to sort of help him out. But of course, it's all nonsense. But Mount James is in the plot. That's a crucial thing. they go to the post telegraph office, and by a cunning ruse, they get to read part of the telegram, but by no means all of it. And by showing the counterforward of the message that Staunton sent. And it was addressed to a man called Dr. Leslie Armstrong, who is, a high up, it says, a medical academic at Cambridge. So they go and see him, and he's wonderfully rude. They go to Cambridge, and he is wonderfully rude to them. But you just say, you know, look, Staunton is a friend of mine. He's got many fine attributes, so maybe just leave him alone. You know, it's none of your business, really. Which, I must admit, is a fair point. Holmes sort of brings out his papers and says, there's a letter to you, so you know more about this. And Armstrong is furious at this, denies everything, throws him out the room. And this is great news for Holmes, because he loves this, because it means there's something going on, because he's really, really annoyed somebody. If he hadn't annoyed them, then, you know, that'd be a bit of a dead end. So Holmes and Watson's had to stay the night. They found out that Leslie Armstrong takes a regular sort of ride out into the country, and Holmes follows him one night. He leaves Watson in his room and follows him, but it doesn't get anywhere. He basically just leads him back again, takes him in a big massive detour, and he comes back again. Holmes isn't deterred by this, quite enjoys it. In fact, there's a reference to Moriarty, he's quite pleased that, you know, Dr. Armstrong is a formidable opponent. He's really pleased with it. The next day, they try again, but Holmes lets him go because he says to Watson, I want to bring in another detective. The other detective is a dog. He's a beagle called Pompey. Pompey probably being a little nod to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's days at Portsmouth, I'm guessing. But this time Holmes sprays the axle of the broom with aniseed, so the dog can track him down quite comfortably. This they do, and they finally get to, they go far into the countryside, and they find the house where Staunton is. They find Staunton, but he's not alone. He's sitting with his, happens to be his wife, who has just died of consumption, which of course is very, very triggering for Watson, having done the same with Mary. Mary Morstan, I don't know if that's happened yet, or no, I don't think it has happened yet. The reason for their all secrecy is because Mad James wouldn't approve of the marriage and wouldn't give them a penny. So Armstrong has basically been sort of talking to the woman's father about what's going on, they've been sort of keeping it secret away from Mad James. And that's it. Holmes tells Armstrong that there's no foul play, private affairs aren't any of his business, and he just leaves him to it, which is what he should be doing. And that's the end of The Missing Three-Quarter.
Our guest to discuss The Missing Three-Quarter is Madeline Quiñones. I will get it right, Madeline, one day. That's as close as you're going to get. Madeline joined us when we discussed the Greek interpreter, and is currently in Michigan, not far from the Indiana border. We've discussed this offline. Last time we spoke, Madeline, you told a very, very excited John and I about the John H. Watson Society.
Yes.
Bearing in mind that there is a section of this show called Watson Watch, which, I'll be honest, doesn't last very long. Because we've discovered that John H. Watson doesn't do that much apart from sort of withhold truth and you know, things like that. So how's it all going? It's been a couple of years since we spoke to you, so how's it all going there?
Well, the John H. Watson Society has now moved from a subscription-based model to being totally free to join.
Okay.
So, you can go to our website, which is very helpfully johnhwatsonsociety.com, and fill out a form, and then I get back to you with the information that you need to know. And we are still publishing the journal, but we are doing it through Amazon self-publishing now.
Okay.
For various reasons, we just couldn't stick with the model that we were on, but we still have meetings on Zoom every month, and
Madeline's just put a thumb up to herself. and self-congratulation at the society.
My computer likes to generate kind of emoji symbols when I do different things with my hands. That's the joy of having a Mac with my current operating system. Anyway, yeah, so we still regularly meet, and sometimes because, yes, John Watson does so little in the stories, it can be a challenge to figure out what we're doing for our meetings. But we manage, and the Watsonian Weekly still drops an episode every week, which is insane. But these days we are also currently reviewing episode by episode the new adaptation Sherlock and Co., which is really excellent, and it's another modern day update, but Watson is podcasting.
Oh, okay.
So it's a lot of fun.
I like the idea of Watson podcasting.
He's so bad at it. It's so funny.
Of course he is.
Yeah, yeah. But it, you would, in terms of like Watson Watch, you would love it because he actually does so much in the show. And sometimes, and oftentimes, you know, actually actively helps out in the investigation. So it's a lot of fun.
He doesn't sit in a chair like he does in the Musgrave Ritual and just sort of nod and say yes, Holmes, and copy things down. That was the shortest ever Watson Watch we've ever had. What does he do, John? He sits in a chair and listens, and then he writes it all down afterwards. I don't know what we're going to do when we do.
He tried to get Holmes to clean his room, but...
Well, that is true, yeah. That's his new career, some sort of reality TV, clean your room, Sherlock. Oh, yes, but here's the jewellery of the King of England or whatever it was. at the time, I quite like the idea of that. John, I don't know what we do with Watson Watch when we get to the Blanche Soldier and the Lion's Mane. That's going to be that will be the shortest ever Watson Watch, I think. I've had an idea about that actually. What we could do
is I'm sure that counts.
They get mentioned, yeah. We could use that episode to talk about Watson's wives, as in how many. Where are they in the timeline and things like that? But anyway, we're not here to discuss that. We're here to discuss the missing three quarter. Well, the first question is a pretty obvious one. Madeline, did you enjoy it? There we go. And that's the answer right there, everyone.
It's not like I disliked it. I just don't have any strong feelings about it either way.
That's exactly where I am. There is someone on this podcast, I'm not mentioning any names, who can't remember even reading it. So I get to ask this question genuinely, like as if for the first time. John, did you enjoy The Missing Three Quarter?
It was all right. I have read, you know, the complete works, I don't know how many times. I have listened to the Stephen Fry audiobook end to end, I don't know how many times. I've listened to every episode of the Bert Cools adaptations. I can't remember a single thing about this story. Reading it today, it's like I've read it for the first time ever. And I don't know.
Also, especially like a lost manuscript to you.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah. I mean, there's other ones where I'm just like, I don't remember this story. And then when I've read it, I'm like, oh yeah, I remember it now and stuff like that. It's nothing.
It's the coconut matting in the alleyway, the hallway one, that one. I get that, yeah. That sort of thing. I think The Missing Three Quarter, and I keep saying this about some of the other shows, I think it's par. There's things about it which I really like. I think the thing I like about it most is that it's got nods to other stories without having one of its own. I'm going to get into some themes on this. And this one... this one I find particularly irritating because we're doing this in order. And it keeps coming up every single time. Madeline, they're back in Cambridge again, aren't they? So the question's going to be, where did Holmes go to university? And can I just say, I really have stopped caring about where Holmes went to university.
Yeah. I think it's actually their first time in Cambridge, because in, like, the three students... They're just
a university
like,
town.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It is interesting though. I did note that Holmes, I don't know if it's just because he went out bicycling, but he claims to have some familiarity with like the area, with the terrain.
He says Watson seems that he does.
Yeah, exactly.
Flatters the face of your hand or something, he says. But then in the same story, he says something like, here we are friendless in this inhospitable town, which sort of sounds like he's just got off the train for the first time and doesn't fancy it. But there's also
he did also like quit college before he was done with it. So
I was gonna say it could just be he didn't enjoy university, so he just doesn't like Cambridge because the memories or something. You know?
Yeah, that's entirely possible. I don't have any stake in this game. It's just kind of funny to sit back and watch the arguments about it.
Oh, yeah, there's obviously the Gloria Scott's the other one where he talks about his years at Cambridge when he met Victor Trevor. And I know I say this every time this comes up, but when we had the late, great Nick Utekin on, and I asked him, did he go to Oxford or Cambridge? He told me that he's the author of Sherlock Holmes in Oxford. It's pretty much answered that question. All right. Bit of research when they got a miss there, to be honest. Nick sort of funny side, as he often did. I'm a bit tired of this. John, did you go to uni? Where did you go? If you did,
I went to Swansea and then the Open.
Okay, I suspect Madeline's answer is going to be slightly different. Did you go to uni, Madeline?
I went to a community college. Tried to go on to art school, but the funding for that fell through. So.
I went to Thames Polytechnic, except that in the year after I left it, basically polytechnics were basically like working class universities.
I was going to say, I don't even know what a polytechnic is really. I've heard of them, but I don't know what they are.
So basically I went to a polytechnic. It's basically a non-fee paying university, but the degree is exactly the same. So the year after I graduated, that became the University of Greenwich. A lot more regal and beautiful area now. But I went, I'm sorry if anyone is listening to this and thinking, how dare you slag off? But basically, my university years were spent in Woolwich in Southeast London. And that was inhospitable a lot of the time while I was there. And so I think if Holmes did go to Cambridge, he and I had very different university experiences. There was the odd riot there while I was there. Also some very angry soldiers, because there's a barracks there as well. The Woolwich Barracks is quite famous. Who just thought they'd attack students occasionally? Not me, I got away with that. But it always amused me when people say, oh, yes, I'm sure he went to Oxford, I'm sure he went to Cambridge. I'm thinking, this is a different world from where I am. This will mean nothing to you, Madeline, at all, but I can tell John that Halen Pace went to my university.
Oh, okay.
One of whom has been in Doctor Who, which we must stop talking about.
Both of them.
Are they both in them?
Yep, same episode.
They're in Survival?
Yeah, both in Survival.
Oh, God, of course they were, yeah. Oh, it's because I know somebody who knows one of them, and I can't remember which one it is. is he Oxford? Is it Oxford or Cambridge? I think the pleasing thing about this story is I don't think we get to discuss that ever again. which is a strange thing. Where did Sir Arthur go?
Edinburgh.
Was it just Edinburgh? He didn't sort of do a secondary thing in...
I believe it was just Edinburgh, but let me just do a quick wiki look.
Sorry, I should keep broadcasting while this is going on. So John, I'll tell you. Well, see, this is John's job, not yours. He's Wikipedia.
I'm trying, but my internet's being very slow.
Okay. Well, I can tell you, because I don't think I mentioned this on the last show, that I went to Edinburgh quite recently, and I went to see the statue. I went to see where he was born, and no one told me that his house isn't there anymore, because I spent a good half an hour walking around thinking, where's number 7, or whatever it was.
University of Edinburgh Medical School.
Yeah.
And he also studied practical botany at the Royal Botanic Garden in Edinburgh.
Portsmouth Eye Hospital and also ophthalmology in Vienna. So I think that's the extent of it.
Sorry, it's very loud where I live.
He didn't actually graduate from Vienna, though, did he? Because he struggled with the German.
Right.
So he didn't go to Oxford or Cambridge, and yet he seems weirdly obsessed with both of them. And but we know about Sir Arthur that his knowledge of London is limited, to say the least. Or at least he lived there for a bit. I'm going to come on to that a bit later on.
I mean, for someone who studied medicine, his medical knowledge is also quite limited, considering the key word for everything is give them a large glass of brandy.
Large glass of brandy, yeah. That's the last thing. That's the first thing that everything goes to.
Bleeding to death. We'll have a glass of brandy and a plaster.
Well, also, they had brain fever, didn't they? So
brain
fever, always cured by lying down or brandy, one of the two. And you're a doctor, are you? Okay.
I mean, to be fair, how much more did real doctors actually do back then?
Probably very little,
wasn't a whole lot.
I mean, most of it was probably just poison from lead paint and cyanide and asbestos. Yeah. God knows what else was just in the houses and the toys and just everything.
That's exactly right.
God leads thrown in every now and then.
Yep.
The other thing, we've never discussed this on the show, Madeline. The show also starts with a drug reference, and I think it might be the first one since Sign of Four. It probably isn't, now I think.
I think you might be right, although, shoot, I should have pulled out. You know what? Can you give me just a second?
Yep.
Let me try to find something.
Me and John will have a chat about Edinburgh. So the statue there, and I found out later that apparently they saw a statue, there's claw marks in the hand of the Baskervilles, and I didn't bother looking at it. I don't know if that's actually true or not, but. Well, there's a pub on the corner, what have you.
I'm also having a look at this. Man twisted lip, you've got him in the opium den, but obviously that's not...
Yeah, but that's work, isn't it?
He's got to do the cover, yeah.
Yes!
I'm sure there's a short story on as well.
All right. So I found my autumn 2016 Baker Street Journal, and which was really funny because it was like a random subscription that I had at the time and then didn't like subscribe to the BSJ again for several years. And I didn't even read this at the time, but it has an article in it from someone who is now like one of my best friends. But, Monica Schmidt, who is a therapist and specializes in substance abuse, has written a paper called The 7% Evaluation.
Right.
So she actually goes into the criteria for diagnosing someone, diagnosing Holmes specifically with whether he not or not he has a substance abuse issue with cocaine. And trying to evidence. So she goes through every time. Yeah, it gets mentioned in Scandal in Bohemia. 5 Orange Pips.
Is it?
Man with a Twisted Lip. And Yellow Face, actually.
Yeah, because he's bored. And that's right. He says my case is empty, Doctor, for which I thank you, or something. think he's so, like, I think that's yellow face.
Yeah, so she runs through the evidence from the canon and then runs through the diagnostic criteria that she would use to diagnose somebody with a substance abuse issue. And let's see. She says near at the end, but if we are to believe everything that Watson has written about Holmes and include this passage from the missing three-quarter in our analysis, then Holmes meets as many as 8 of the diagnostic criteria, enough to move the diagnosis from moderate to severe. Therefore, according to the DSM-5 and the rough translation of the diagnostic criteria into the common vernacular, Sherlock Holmes was most certainly a cocaine addict.
Yeah, it's strange how it's referenced twice in the story as well. It's obviously because he sees the syringe of aniseed.
Mm-hmm.
And Watson doesn't bring it to the reader's attention. Holmes does, and says, "Don't worry about that. I'm going to use that for something else, which I won't tell you about for a few minutes. The way people do."
I think Watson seems alarmed when he sees that syringe.
Yeah, he is.
I think it's providing background earlier on in the story about why it would alarm him.
Yeah.
For casual readers, not obsessive fanatics like ourselves.
Yeah, but I also find it interesting that the stories you just mentioned there are all very, very, very early stories, including, I think, there's two references in the first 4 stories, I think. I can't remember where Five Warren Fit sits in, but obviously it's definitely mentioned in Scandal of Bohemia.
Mm-hmm.
So and obviously this is written decades after that, so he's probably, or a decade afterwards, and he's probably thinking, oh yeah, I forgot to mention that that Sherlock doesn't buy a bit of arm drug occasionally, you know.
Yeah.
I find that quite strange. The fact we're talking about this, and it's genuinely interesting, and we haven't mentioned the story.
Probably reflects the changing attitudes to cocaine as well.
Yeah.
Because at one point in the Victorian era, cocaine was this miracle wonder drug that was used in everything. You know, it's in the original recipe for Coca-Cola. Freud swore by it. But then I think, you know, when was this published?
1904, I think.
1904. By then, have the attitudes towards cocaine changed, and its addictiveness and harmfulness being recognized by the wider public?
Yeah, I think it's also quite interesting in some ways that Holmes takes Watson's advice, admittedly begrudgingly, for quite some time. And then he just sort of lets him win and says, yeah, you're right. And Holmes doesn't strike me in mind as going to say, yes, but I'm enjoying this. My mind is very active when I'm on it, but I'll stop that because you said so. I suppose that's the respect of the doctor. And that's one of the few occasions where Watson wins, I think, and something between him. He's still incredibly rude, especially to women, you know, things like that. But he does that. So I think I'm always really interested in the starts of short stories. I love the fact that Watson says straight away, nothing's going on. It's like August at work for me. Nothing is happening at all. Before we get on to it. So he gets the visitor of Cyril Overton. I absolutely love Cyril Overton's entrance. And yes, there's blah, 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 but he can't sprint for nuts. He's got no pace. And he just goes on and goes, I assure you, my dear sir, you know, and he just talks over him. John, you're Welsh.
I was going to say, actually, this is how I feel, Carl, when you talk about football and Liverpool and stuff like that.
Well, surely as a Welshman yourself, you probably threw yourself over some ropes at some point in your youth. I know nothing about rugby at all. Never been to a single game.
Well, it's interesting. That, you know, rugby, I think, in England is quite like, or at least back then, it was quite an upper class thing. You know, whereas in Wales, it's very working class. Working class.
Madeline, I love that we brought you on to talk about rugby. Did you play much rugby in Michigan at all, do you?
You know, there is rugby in the States. But no, I am I have zero interest in any sports aside from racing. Or if Michigan teams are outplaying other teams, I'm gonna support them. Especially if they're playing Ohio.
Yeah.
And that's a joke. That's a very Midwestern joke right there.
Okay. Well, John's from Swansea, so there's a club, the Scarlets.
Scarlet is to Netley.
There's a big rivalry
between the Swansea team and the Tlethley team. My father's from Tlethley, though, so he was a Scarlet supporter.
They beat the All Blacks in 19 something or other. I know that's
a really famous match. Yeah, 1970 something. Yeah.
And things like that. So I found it quite interesting that he's brought rugby into this, because we've already done the turf, haven't we, in Silver Blaze. And we're going to go back to that again for Shoshkam Old Place at some point. So he doesn't mention sport that often. Apparently, Overton's speech is full of errors. if you can do this, you can do this, as somebody says in there. So it's our first rugby thing. Also, in the annotated, somebody makes a very good point of how come Holmes know nothing about rugby, when he very clearly went to university and very possibly a public school, where and back then, as John says, rugby was the posh man's sport, and then it went the other way to in sort of Welsh mining communities and things like that. So that I'm not saying that's an error, but I absolutely love that rant at the beginning. I just think it's I love when someone comes in and basically says Holmes and Watson's story. No, I'm in charge of the next page. I love that. I just think it was so nice. Incidentally, on the BBC adaptation version, which isn't a Burt story, there's my first reference to him, they do a thing where Watson says that the missing three quarters is probably a reference, because they're sitting there with the paper and they're trying to work out what this means, what the hell is a missing three quarter. And Watson says, oh, it's about pigeon racing. And he's on the Strand, which is next to Charing Cross Station, because there's an important pigeon event going on. Or something like that, and
what an introduction that is, isn't it?
And to be honest, when I reread it this week, I feel a bit let down that the pigeon bit's missing. I thought that's one of the best things about the story. That's not fair. So, Madeline, we've been here before, haven't we? With strange visitors coming to Baker Street with strange stories. Holmes has a clear day for once.
Mm-hmm.
He uses those words. I have a clear day.
It is February.
He's got a clear month by the sounds of things. Watson's anything to go by.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he goes to the hotel, and they have the episode with the writing paper, which I didn't know is there's an illustration of that, which I still couldn't read it. When I saw it in the annotated, it seems to me that there's some. This story is just made up of other stories. So this bit reminded me of the Reigate puzzle or Reigate Squires, in as much as it's a piece of paper that's going to lighten up the truth, because it doesn't, it does the opposite. But then it brings in, I think, the second biggest star of the show. What is your view on Lord Mount St. James? Please don't get this wrong.
I mean, he's funny, for sure.
I absolutely love him. It's so preposterous.
Yeah, he's very ridiculous.
And I can't believe he gets duped by the old, yes, but you've got to help us because he's after your money, my lord. And he just falls for that instantly. And so does Watson, by the way. Watson's completely duped by the whole thing. Sorry, John.
Is it a thing, you know, when I imagined him walking in my mind's eye, I just pictured Scrooge McDuck.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. He also has one of the finest lines in the whole canon, which I think justifies this whole story, was, "I came as fast as the Bayswater omnibus would carry me." Oh, the word omnibus to describe a bus. Absolutely tremendous. My God, I love that. The Bayswater omnibus. I think that's just an incredible thing. Sorry, Madeline's reading at the moment. I think she's addicted to stories of cocaine and Victorian literature. I think that's probably what's going on.
Yeah, I'm just really happy to have I just bought this. You know, Oxford University Press is re-releasing their annotated Sherlock Holmes in paperback format. So okay. I have the second. This is the second edition of The Return, and I have Study in Scarlet and Memoirs, and I'm supposed to also be getting The Adventures and Hound of the Baskervilles, but I think that currently they're stuck in the Nine Circles of Hell trying to get to me, okay. But they're stuck in New York, I think, in customs or something.
Okay.
If I'm understanding correctly, the notifications I'm getting from the post office.
Does it say much about the missing three-quarter? Because it doesn't seem to be a great deal of going.
Yeah, there's some stuff in here. Yeah.
Mostly about the rules of rugby.
There's actually not a whole. Yeah, there's some stuff about the rugby, but it's only part of. Some of the notes in here are about the differences between the manuscripts and what ended up in the Strand, because they're using the Strand editions, and then differences between what's in the Strand and what was in Collier's.
Yeah.
In the US.
I'm coming to this. I'm so glad you brought that up, because it's another example of Sir Arthur and London. It says in the original manuscript that when they go to Cambridge, they go down the Strand and they go to Fenchurch Station. Fenchurch Station still exists. I've been there once in my life, bearing in mind I lived in London for 30 years. You go to King's Cross, up Gray's Inn Road, which I thought might be a nod to Dickens, because I used to work on the same on the road where the Dickens Museum is. So that's quite a nice little nod to Dickens, I thought. I don't know what, and fair enough, it was correct as these things happen, but I'm so happy that he thought, I'm going to go to Fenchurch Street to go to Cambridge, because that just told me Sir Arthur didn't get the train much, and he certainly didn't get it to Cambridge, because he wouldn't have got it from there. It's mostly Essex, I think, Fenchurch Street is. It's not far from Liverpool Street, which I think you can go to Cambridge from. So that really pleased me. We're going to bring this round to home turf for you, Madeline, because there is no one in the whole Sherlock world who knows more about Watson Watch than you. Talk me through Watson Watch, please, for the missing three-quarter. John just took a big swig there, thinking, I'm not needed for the next 5 minutes. What does he do?
Well, he doesn't know anything about Dr. Leslie Armstrong.
Absolutely nothing. And yet, if you compare that with the resident patient, where he's heard of Percy Trevelyan.
Yeah.
And read his obscure article on nervous lesions. And yet, Dr. Leslie Armstrong, a man with a European reputation.
That's so weird.
And yet, I want you to save the reputation of John H. Watson in The Missing Three-Quarter. Sit back, everyone. There's no pressure here.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, Holmes even, like, tells him, stay put in the inn, because we don't need two strangers running around and investigating things, because that'll just set the town talking.
Yeah, he's told to do less.
Yeah. Yeah, poor Watson. He just doesn't have anything to do. And it is funny. It's too bad that Doyle didn't have the idea sooner, you know, that Watson was a former rugby player, because you could so easily have tied that in here. But okay. So here is something that I did note, and this was very funny to me. You know, since Overton at the beginning, you know, goes on a tear, and then Holmes is like, okay, I need you to calm down and tell me what's going on here. And
even there is work for me.
And Watson says, but by degrees, with many repetitions and obscurities, which I may omit from his narrative, he laid his strange story before us. And I just like that. With many repetitions and obscurities, which I may omit. Watson's just like, yeah, this whole story was just absolutely unprintable in its original state. And I am just going to give you the basics here. So I think that that is actually the most that Watson does in the missing three quarters.
Bearing in mind, according to the Sussex Vampire, Watson didn't just play. He played for Richmond, which is a proper team that I'm still going today. Still very, very strong team. That's a National League team.
Blackheath.
I thought it was Blackheath.
Oh, is it Blackheath? Sorry, Bob, whatever his name is, he played for Richmond, didn't he? That's right, the old Deer Park. Name is the old Deer Park, which is still the thing today. He played for Blackheath.
Yeah.
Is there a rugby team in Blackheath? I used to live in Blackheath. Definitely no rugby team when I was there. But you think if someone comes in and says, oh, yes, he's really a half and he can't sprint for this, and yes, he's good for that, and he's using lots of rugby vernacular, Watson's on his phone or something, you know, scrolling through TikTok reels. Are they reels on TikTok? I don't know.
Blackheath is the fourth oldest rugby club in continuous existence.
Sorry, I'll say that again.
Blackheath is the fourth oldest rugby club in continuous existence.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I've just said that I used to live there and I didn't even know that. So I lived at the other end. I think I know where that would be.
But you're not a rugby person, so.
Well, I'm not, no, but you think I'm very much a sports person. or sport in particular. But I support anyone with the word Michigan in it, as of now. so I find that, I think Watson's story is, he's so far down the billing. He's behind the dog, Watson, because Pompey's a hero in this. In terms of the best characters in this story, for me, it's Leslie Armstrong. I do generally think he's great. Although he changes his mind very quickly and said, I want to shake your hand.
Change his mind really quickly,
Incredibly quickly, and he's beautifully curt to him. He sends him a fantastic letter, basically saying, you're an idiot, leave me alone. Which he doesn't have to do. And then, so we've got him, then what's that, Lord Mount James, then the dog, then Overton, then Sherlock, and somewhere right at the very back of the pack, in terms of importance, is the man who's narrating the whole thing. I think it's extra. I'm really, really slagging the story. John, you've read this for the first time.
Apparently.
Am I wrong in that billing?
About Watson? Yeah, I think in terms of importance, he's he's behind the missing guy. He's behind the corpse.
He does get to be a doctor at the end. I've got to say that.
He's somewhere along, I don't know, all these nameless pub landlords are more important than Watson, as are all the people who work at the post office and porters and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness sake.
In fact, the man who works in the hotel is ahead of him. I'd even argue that the pencil with which he wrote the telegram might be... But anyway, more importantly, it's got a dog in it. Yeah. And it's got the first dog in it since Sign of Four, I think. There's a dog in Shoshkamel Place, obviously, which is how he solves the identity of Lady Watson.
The Baskervilles.
Yeah.
Oh, the Baskervilles. That's very dog related. I'll give you that, yeah.
There's also the dog in Copper Beaches.
Copper Beaches, yeah. Which is, as we've said on the show, the first thing Watson does in the entire canon. He shoots the dog. Other than that, he's sitting in chairs a lot. Can I say, by the way, I love Watson. I absolutely adore Watson. But I'm always more interested in what he's leaving out than what he says, I think.
Yeah.
More than anything else. I think he's defending his own reputation a bit for a lot of this, just by saying, no, no, I definitely didn't do that. It's got Pompey the dog. I can't remember the name of the dog in The Sign of Four. Toby.
Toby.
Yeah, Toby. That's right, yeah. And Toby gets it wrong because he's undone by some creosote or something.
Yeah.
He goes to the wrong place. But, John, you had thoughts on Pompey.
I love the aniseed thing. Because apparently this is a genuine thing.
It is, yeah, absolutely.
It's like catnip.
It's catnip, yeah. Yeah. And I love how Holmes is so smug about it when he says, when Watson says, should we get after him, Holmes, in a rare moment of non-sedentary life from the doctor. Yeah, he's very, very active. And he says, oh, I think he says something like, you'd be a very, very clever man to outrun me today, or, you know, what I've got going on.
Watson is desperate to do something in this story.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want me to get in the bike and chase after him? And Holmes is like,
yeah. No, you've done far too much.
Poor Watson, he's just like, Holmes, doggone it, let me do something. Anything. Yeah,
come on. This action scenes are my business. Here we go. Come on, let's do this. No, I've got a dog in, actually, John, to be honest. The dog's going to do it all. I still don't understand the ending. I mean, I do.
It just ends.
Yeah. And it ends very abruptly.
Yeah. He reaches word count, or?
Yeah, exactly. He's got his 1,400 words done. So basically, Godfrey Staunton, weirdly, it might be the first time we've named him on this show. Bearing in mind it's about him. He is the missing three-quarter. He marries someone supposedly beneath his station, I'm guessing, which is a common theme, isn't it, throughout this time. He doesn't want Mount James to know, so he keeps it a secret. How, Madeline, is that sustainable?
I mean, Mount James is like, what, 80-something?
Yep.
So I think the idea is we're just going to outlast him.
Yep. That's it.
Yeah.
I'm just going to stuck you in the middle of the fens out of nowhere, unless he's detected by a dog. I don't really get that. And I don't understand what the problem is with Mount James, who's pretty reluctant to give him money, even when he thinks he's in danger, never mind, you know, to help him with his young family. Because he seems like quite a nice man and everything, so she's obviously going to be quite a nice woman. I don't really understand why he would be reluctant to pay his inheritance out. In fact, he even says that he's not giving Godfrey Staunton, a farthing, he says, or something.
Yeah.
A shilling, maybe.
It's still all going to go to Godfrey when...
Yeah, I suppose so. He's just not getting it immediately. But he's not getting it now.
Unless, of course, it's some kind of trust or something like that, like inheritance trust, it's...
But would it be determinant on marrying the right sort of chap?
It could be. Well, I suppose it could be that if he's, you know, got the money in trust or something, he might, you know, have like an issue, like he's his ward or something until he's 21 or something like that.
Yeah,
he's a university student.
He's not university, yeah.
You know, depending what he's studying, you know, he could be doing like a PhD or something. So he could be in his mid-20s or something, we know. Yeah.
Could be trying to be a vet. So it ends very abruptly for me, to be honest.
It ends.
It's very sort of, here's the mystery. His wife's died, she had consumption. That's obviously very, very triggering for Watson. Because obviously this is after the hiatus, isn't it? So Mary's died at this point, you'd assume. And it goes from that to Leslie Armstrong saying, do you know what? I hate your guts. No, actually, I think you're the greatest man who's ever lived. To, God, I love you, Sherlock. Give us a hug. Come on, give me some love here. to the end. It just seems really strange. I mean, when I read in the I read the annotated version, and I literally went from let's leave them to it, Watson, wherever the ending is, to the rules of rugby on the same page, and I just carried on running, thinking surely there's more. Oh no, now he's talking about the rules of rugby, which I really should read in preparation for things like this.
Yeah. No, I think that the abrupt ending bothers everybody. I've never heard this story talked about without that coming up.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not the first time he's done that. And obviously he's got a word count and he's got to... what surprised me about it is I think Conan Doyle's greatest skill, like George Orwell, is that he never wastes a word. Everything is just piled in immediately. And there's nothing wasted whatsoever. And with this one, he certainly didn't waste an ending because he didn't bother with it. Which is quite strange. I think we've pretty much exhausted the missing three quarter. Bearing in mind, we spent most of that talking about cocaine use.
I mean, we didn't mention that Holmes wanted Armstrong to be the new Moriarty.
Well, again, this is your level of expertise, being a big fan of the professor, aren't you? it's not the first time he's done that. He's what he likes a Moriarty figure in his life.
Yeah.
He likes that challenge.
I think it's actually the first time, though, that it comes up like this. I mean, I think if I... Like, thinking back over the other stories, I think that the only other time that another character really gets compared to Moriarty is Baron Gruner, an illustrious client.
Yep.
And that's that hasn't been written yet. And in fact, even in terms of chronology, the story also hasn't happened yet.
Nope.
So,
I like Baron Gruner. I like that.
He's so evil.
He's beautifully evil.
Yeah, he's such a great character to hate.
I think Moriarty, doesn't he say to, I've forgotten his name, in The Norwood Builder, Josiah somebody. When he works out that the house is the problem and that there's a secret room, and he says, doesn't he say something like, you're no Moriarty? Like, he's appalled at him for not being back. I think he does that a few times.
I don't remember.
Or mentions him anyway.
I mean, definitely at the start of The Norwood Builder, he's like,
he misses him.
Yeah, yeah.
He misses him, wishes he was alive so he could have another go.
Yeah. Well, a few years ago, and this is just stuck in my memory, we were discussing this story at the Parallel Case of St. Louis on Zoom, which, you know, is hosted by your friend and mine, Rob Nunn. And we ended up talking about the Moriarty Armstrong thing for a long time, and also the cocaine. And it was suggested that maybe Holmes is especially latching on to the idea of having a new Moriarty if he's of feeling the like. He's cut cocaine out of his life, but he doesn't have anything to replace it.
He needs the action.
Yeah.
He needs
and
the
I mean,
action.
And that's the thing that that Monica always brings up in regards to addiction, is that it's not the addiction isn't the problem. The addiction is treating the problem.
Yeah.
So Holmes has gotten rid of his, you know, self-medication, but now he needs something to make up for that.
Yeah. I've just finished a book about a famous footballer over here, who has alcohol, specifically gambling, and cocaine use, a narcotics addiction, although he's conquered that one. And all the way through it, he says, the problem is not the drugs or the gambling. It's the high that I need to get through the day.
Mm-hmm.
And I need that level of attention because I can't be stuck in boredom with my own thoughts. I think there's elements of that. Yes, okay, I've got, you're right, Watson. it's not good for me. I'll get away from that. But what I do need is a criminal mastermind, murderous criminal mastermind, ideally. Could it be him? No, because he's my friend now. I can't really, you know. And he's clever because he's a doctor and, you know, when he writes aggressive notes and what have you, and doesn't, you know, send him down, you know, 12-mile diversions around the Fenland or things like that. So, yeah, I think that is a very strong point. He's desperate for a Moriarty.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny because that's kind of that itself is kind of a nostalgia filter, because yeah. he's missing like what he thinks of as the good things about Moriarty being around. You know, he's not actually missing being in deadly danger or Watson being in deadly danger.
Yeah.
But that's the trap of nostalgia.
Yeah, and they touch on the BBC series. They touch about Watson and his stick and his limp that suddenly goes missing once exciting things start to happen, which I think is a Mark Gatiss thing rather than Conan Doyle thing, obviously. But
yeah, the BBC series kind of turns in its head by having Watson as the addict. He's addicted to danger and risk.
Yeah.
And things like that. Whereas Holmes, he's the one who, you know, dabbles in drugs and things like that, but he's never seems to be dependent on it compared to Watson.
Yeah. That reminds me actually of, again, this is where I don't know if it's a Radio 4 thing or because I haven't read it for a while, in The Dying Detective, which apparently I'm doing with someone called John Reese, where Holmes says the most trickiest thing about being ill and malingering for 3 days and making sure no one can get to see the belladonna on his face and things like that is that he hasn't had a cigarette.
It's
in every version. I can't remember if this is just the Jeremy Brett quote, but
it's in the canon.
Is one thing, but to be 3 days without tobacco has been most irksome.
Most irksome, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Speaking of which, I've never actually written for any Sherlock magazine, but I'm allegedly a writer here and cover most things. I've just written 3,500 words on George Hutcheson, in fact, John. But you're looking forward to reading that. George Hutcheson, Jack the Ripper thing, which I'm obsessed with. And it's about a man who walks down the street, claims he's met someone, and then stands outside a house for 45 minutes. And I still managed to get 3,500 words out of it. I'm actually quite tempted to write something about Sherlock and alcohol. Because it does seem there's times when they have a small beer together or an ale or something, but every now and then, but they're really hitting the big lads there, brandy and whiskey all the time. Another brandy. Oh, thank you. They're getting through a fair old and often seems to be most of Watson's work. And I think if they're just doing that, and yes, they're drinking it with water, but it is only water, so I'm quite interested. I might go through the canon and try and work out how many references there are to alcohol and what have you.
I think that sounds worth doing.
Yeah, there's a lot of it, and obviously that's not confined just to Holmes and Watson, but I'm a big fan of the Bertie Wooster stories, James Wilson, and he does not get through the stuff, Bertie. He absolutely, but they make a joke about it, you know. Two cocktails before dinner, and then it's pretty much whiskey and soda for the rest of the day.
Off topic for a second, Carl. Have you ever read the Rivers of London novels by Ben Aronovich?
No.
He was a Doctor Who author in the 80s. He's written a series of novels and novellas called Rivers of London. It's about magic and things like that. The latest one is a Bertie Wooster pastiche.
Oh, really?
Set in 1920s New York. I read it yesterday. I've never read any Woodhouse, so I'm just told it's quite a good pastiche of it, but I enjoyed it.
Oh, excellent. Okay. One thing I didn't mention this story is Jeremy Dixon, who owns the dog Pompey. Pompey is, of course, an abbreviation for Portsmouth, which is where Sir Arthur was in goal for. And the reason I mentioned that's reminded me of Bertie Wooster is because the Worcester stories have just the greatest character names ever. My favourite one, without question, is Catsmeat Potter Purbright. Catsmeat Potter Purbright. Fantastic. Lovely.
One of these days I need to get into the Woodhouse stuff.
Start with the Inimitable Jeeves. Buy the Inimitable Jeeves tonight.
I think I did buy it. I don't have put it though.
Oh, it's easy because it's short stories rather than the novels, that one. Because I think we've pretty much finished with the Mission Three Quarter. The glory of them is, and I've written about this quite recently, for example, a lot of the story is about Bertie being engaged to someone he doesn't want to be engaged to, and he can't just say, no, I don't want to marry you, because that would be rude. You can't do that. So mostly it's Jeeves saying, I'll find a way that you're not going to marry Lady Florence Cray, who wants to make him read Shakespeare and talk about, as he says, birds called Tolstoy with strange political thoughts. And there's so much going on about nonsense that you'll forget that the biggest problem is he's engaged to Lady Florence Cray. And then at the very end, it ties together and it's just so well done. But he just sends you on four or five different things all the time, including things like he's got to steal an ornamental cow creamer, like a jug in the shape of a cow. But the man he's stolen it from is a fascist who hates him and is going to beat him up. And you know, if you send that off to a publisher, I don't think it's not much of a story, is it? Oh my God, what a story. Because while he's doing that, he's also got to rescue two of his friends' marriage. He's got to, just tons of things. He's got to stop his aunties from doing strange things. He's petrified of another auntie, and he's also engaged to Lady Florence Cray.
I do think
it's written in the most beautiful language. It's so funny.
I do think modern literature suffers from the fact that short stories are no longer in fashion. You know, because so many authors flourished with the short story.
Yeah.
Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, for example.
Absolutely.
I think it's a terrible shame.
Yeah, it's, and I love that. You know, Balzac, considered a genius of the genre. I love the fact that he loved P.G. Wodehouse and wrote all the time. If you want to know how to write short stories, that's why he's the master. He is the master of the short story, because he'll make you forget things, which is an incredibly difficult thing to do when you're a writer, when you're trying to do the opposite. That takes a name. That said, Madeline, thank you for joining us. I just thought I'd talk about a good book at the end there. I don't mind the Missing Three Quarter. I think it's all right. And when it comes up, I keep thinking, oh yeah, Leslie Armstrong, Lord Manson James, the Bayswater Bus.
Sorry, what was this about again? Yeah, I'll have forgotten,
you know,
by next week. Never read it.
Yeah, we're gonna
you
read
know what? Do you want a little piece of Sherlockian trivia history? Related to, so the Baker Street Journal was started in 1945 or 46, something like that. And it was originally like this beautiful, lavish little journal, like very, very well done, very well put together. And it was so nicely published that it ended up bankrupting the publisher.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, I forget. Maybe it was 1948 or 47, somewhere in there. It only went for a couple of years, if I'm remembering this correctly, and then, the first issue of the year went out, and it's a quarterly journal. The first issue went out. And then there were no more Baker Street journals for the rest of the year. And wow. Then it came back the next year in a much cheaper format. So it was able to continue, but there were no more issues for the year that it went bankrupt. So those three missing issues are known as the missing three quarters.
Oh, applause, applause. That is tremendous. That's also the best ending we're ever going to get on this podcast, John. That's amazing.
No one say another word.
No. Thank you for joining us, Madeline. I'm going to get out as soon as you can. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. This is fun.
I would like to thank our host at Rippercast, as well as producers Jonathan Mengus and John Reese. A special thank you too to Andrew Firth, who created both the graphics and the theme music.
You can contact us on Twitter at Adler to Amberley. Thank you for listening.
My dog might bark in a second, just to forewarn you, so you might have to record this if it happens.
What, in protest of me slacking off dog stories?
No, because our fish and chips for dinner are here, so.
Okay.
I love the aniseed thing.
Yeah, that's nice.
With the dog.
There he goes. That is Pompey protesting about his success. Well, maybe Toby protesting about his...
Yeah.
He's not chasing a aniseed-led carriage through the streets of Swansea.
No.